Welcome back to the Universalis podcast. I am Martin Kohinski, the creator of Universalis, and in this episode I'll be looking at the highlights of the week ahead, starting with Sunday the 12th of October. On Sunday the 12th itself, the readings at Mass show people who are outside being brought back inside, and this in two ways. The first way is that both the first reading and the Gospel are about the healing of lepers. Skin diseases are horrible because they are visible, they are highly contagious, and some of them are deadly. Leprosy is particularly horrible because sooner or later infections set in and bits start falling off you. Given that, the law of Moses about leprosy is staggeringly merciful. Lepers are to be kept outside the camp, yes, as a matter of public health. They are marked as unclean and have to shout out that they are unclean. Yes, that is the least they can do for us to warn us. In a strictly practical society, these diseased bodies, these useless mouths, eating but able to do no work for it, this constant potential threat to the rest of the community, we wouldn't actually kill them, but we would drive them out into some waterless place where they would die, and it would not be the fault of any one of us. The law of Moses says, don't do that. The law says, look after these people. Keep them away from you, but feed them and clothe them. They can do no work, so you must do the work they can't do and support them with it. That is humane, but still, of course, the lepers are separate. In the first reading on Sunday, Naaman the Syrian is separate twice over, once by being a leper, a second time by being a Gentile. Elisha, the man of God, has him dip himself seven times in the holy river Jordan. Thus Naaman is cured of his leprosy, cured of his first separateness. For the second separateness, in the Old Testament there is no cure. Naaman wants to give Elisha a gift to thank him, but in the ancient world a gift establishes a relationship which lasts forever. I give to you, you give to me, and so it goes on. So Elisha cannot allow this. Next, Naaman asks for 2 mule loads of earth from the Holy Land, so that wherever he goes, he can worship the Lord on the Lord's own ground. And this Elisha grants. He even gives permission to Naaman to carry on bowing down in the temple of Rimmon when his king goes there and he must accompany him. With the Jews there is this strangely delicate relationship between the chosen people and those not chosen. There is a sort of half-category. Some grand London clubs have country members who live far away from town and can't come often, so they pay a reduced subscription. The Jews did the same sort of thing. There were distant people who could belong in a certain distant sense under slightly different rules. There are hints of it in the Psalms. Sons of Israel, trust the Lord. Sons of Aaron, trust the Lord. And then, you who fear him, trust the Lord. By New Testament times, this category of God-fearers was well established. For instance, there were parts of the temple they could come to, and there were parts of the temple they could not come to. There is a sort of resonance with leprosy. The leper can't be one of us, but still we will feed him. The God-fearer can't be one of us, but he can be nourished, at least, with some of the food that nourishes us. In all this, the word us clearly means the Jews, but it can make sense even when us means us Christians. We certainly shouldn't drag our pagan friends to Mass. It would embarrass them, and it would be pointless unless they knew what was going on, and really it would be disrespectful because we are offering to them, as a quaint freak show, something that is very real and is not quaint at all. So we can't do that, but our atmosphere, that we can share. We don't flaunt our values, but we do let them be seen. We bear witness, and if God wills, that may bring fruit in time. When we move from Sunday's first reading to the Gospel, again there are the two kinds of outsiderness. There is leprosy, and there is not being a Jew. The name and theme is not just sleeping quietly in the Old Testament. Jesus has come to fulfill it. And in the Acts of the Apostles we will see salvation come to the pagans at last. This is all worthwhile stuff for a sermon, and I'm sure you'll get a good one wherever you are. But I am almost certain there is one thing it won't mention, because I only noticed it just now when I looked at the About Today page. By a lovely coincidence, the 12th of October is, in Poland, the memorial of the Polish Jesuit Jan Bezim, who, in 1898, at the age of 48, went to Madagascar to work among lepers. He was the first priest of that mission who actually lived among the lepers instead of looking after them from a safe distance. He dressed and bandaged their wounds. He went begging for money to buy them food and clothing and build them a hospital. The lepers called him Raja Mendreni, which means father and mother, because he was. While we are wandering across the world like this, in Brazil there are no lepers at Mass this weekend, because Sunday the 12th is the solemnity of Our Lady of Aparecida, patroness of Brazil. This business of Our Lady of is disconcerting to upright and uptight people who have been brought up in Protestant countries. Perhaps we don't understand it. Perhaps we fear that if we did understand it and embraced it, our neighbours would decide we were too different from them and start persecuting us again. All the same, Our Lady of is an important part of how salvation works. Some of us have a relationship directly with God the Father, or just God full stop, really. At least that is how it feels. God is the one we talk to. God is the one we ask things, the one we apologize to, the one we thank. We don't feel a need to see his human face, or perhaps we're frightened to see it. Some of us have a relationship with God the Son. We walk the same earth he walked. We try to live like him as far as we are able. We thank him in human terms for the human things he did and suffered for us. When we wake up in the morning with a rotten sore throat and complain to him about it, we know that he knows exactly what it feels like. And some of us, it isn't given to everyone, even meet him now and then, perhaps in a beggar begging for food at a time when we are practically fainting with hunger ourselves. And then for some of us, our relationship is with Mary, the Mother of God. I can't tell what makes one of these relationships happen rather than another. I am not at all sure that one should even try to analyze it like that. But I could make guesses all the same. Mary is the Mother of God, the Mother of Jesus, the Mother of the Church, the Mother of us all. And what can be better than a mother? And another thing, Mary is not God, which in a sense makes us feel safer with her. All the Church asks is that we should remember to treat Mary not as a goddess, but as one of us, that we should ask for her intercession, not her intervention. She prays to God for us, and we, next to her, learn to pray to God a little better ourselves. In the Eastern Church, there's a particular kind of icon of Mary with Jesus called the Virgin Hodegetria, Our Lady Showing the Way. It shows Mary holding the baby Jesus, pointing towards him with one finger. He is the way you should be following, the finger says. Counting all the Our Lady ofs around the world would take the fingers of several hands. Some of these feasts are centred around a painting or a statue. Some were started by visitations from Our Lady herself, often to people who are poor and humble. That is as it ought to be. She seems to like them best. As she said in the Magnificat, the Lord has lifted up the humble. But it's the of part of Our Lady of that I'd really like to focus on. Sometimes we cleverly and complacently say that there are no holy places in Christianity. We don't have a Jerusalem like the Jews. We don't have a Mecca like the Muslims. Jesus sanctified the whole world at once, not one place more than another. That is true, and also very much not true. The thing is, we are incarnate beings. We are bodies as well as souls, inextricably connected. And one thing a physical body always is somewhere. Even if you are an exile, sliced in half between where you are from and where you are at, never quite belonging, never quite not belonging, even then your body will lead you to have some sort of a where of your own, even if it is only a corner of a park where you sometimes go and sit. The holiness of Fatima, Lourdes, Częstochowa, Guadalupe, Aparecida, it doesn't make those places specially holier than other places. What it does do is show us that each place, every place, is holy in its own right, in its own way. And those various places that are celebrated in the feasts, anybody can call them my place. Fatima and Lourdes are my place if I am nobody in particular, young, poor, not specially educated. Częstochowa is my place if I have lost my country to invaders and still, despite that, my country lives. Guadalupe shows that the salvation of God is not only something that was sown in the Holy Land and sprouted and grew there and spread until one day it was brought across the sea to us, the people of the New World, and goodness, aren't we grateful? No, it has seeded itself here in America too and sprouted here, and now we in our turn have something to give to the world. And so it is with Aparecida too. The terracotta statue of Our Lady was made in the early 17th century and somehow found its way into the river Paraíba, where a fisherman found it, broken in two, in 1717. At first he kept it in his house, then a chapel was built for it, then a larger chapel, then in 1834 a basilica, and then a new basilica which was consecrated by Pope John Paul II in 1980, the second largest basilica in the world. It all blew up like a flame in a haystack, and always the impetus came from Mary and from her people. You may wonder, is this mass hysteria? Well, learned people in the Vatican have worried about precisely this question, not just in connection with Aparecida, but for whenever the spirit burns hot among the people. Jesus said, "How I wish the world were burning already," and any parish priest would agree after spending half a lifetime lighting matches and hopefully throwing them onto bundles of what turns out to be damp straw. When the opposite happens, and the flames do flare up to singe everyone's eyebrows, here is what the Vatican bureaucrats have to say. In the light of this authoritative teaching, and of other pronouncements of the Church's magisterium on the pious practices of the Christian people, and drawing on pastoral cases that have emerged in recent years, the Congregation for Divine Worship and the Discipline of the Sacraments has approved this present document, which considers in general terms the relationship between liturgy and popular piety, restates the principles regarding that nexus, and stipulates guidelines for their fruitful implementation in the particular churches in accordance with their specific traditions. By cultivation of a positive and encouraging pastoral stance towards popular piety, therefore, it is for the bishops in a special way to value popular piety, whose fruits have been and remain of major importance in conserving the faith of the Christian people. This comes from the Directory on Popular Piety, a huge document, and there's a link to it in the episode notes this week. The language is heavy, but I find it reassuring that people exist who are able to look at the flaring up of spiritual flame among us and think sensibly about it and keep us energized but also safe. Meanwhile, here is another fact about Aparecida which I didn't know until just the other day. Our Lady of Aparecida is officially listed as patron of all sorts of Our Lady-ish causes, expectant mothers, newborn children, everything that is nice. But she is also, entirely unofficially, the patron saint of bull riders. They wear a pin in the shape of her statue, and inside their hats they wear her portrait. Bull riding is a simple sport done by simple people. The rules are very simple indeed. You get on the back of a bull. Not a calm bull you can ride if you're careful, but a very irritable bull who is in a filthy temper and wants to get you off him and jump on you and squash you flat. To win, all you need to do is stay on his back for 8 seconds. Now, a sceptic might say that these pins and portraits are a kind of amulet to keep the rider safe from danger, and that when you may be less than 8 seconds away from injury, lifelong disability or even death, every little helps. But it isn't that way. What it really is the rider saying to Mary, whether these are my last 8 seconds ever, or the first 8 seconds of the rest of my life, be with me, Mother. And Mary, who was there in the last 8 seconds of her own son's life, says to the rider, whatever happens, good or bad, I will be with you. Because, yes, these simple people, these people who ride bulls, these rough, loud, dirty, smelly people, they don't only do it for the fabulous prizes. They do it as a way of expressing in action who they really are in ordinary life. Someone who will give his life to save others from danger in an instant, not caring, because as one of them said, either I win, which is good, or I am with God forever, which is good as well. Every society needs those people, just as every body needs cells that are willing to die to defend it. My body makes 100,000 million of those cells every day. Every society is a little frightened of the special people who will die, if they have to die to defend it. They try to keep calm by despising those people or ignoring them. But those people, the protectors, the rescuers, they have their own Our Lady of. Our Lady of Aparecida. We have had Madagascar and Poland, we have had Brazil. To continue the theme of faraway places, on Thursday the 16th, we have Ireland and more. The 6th and 7th centuries were the depth of the Dark Ages in Northern Europe. The barbarian invasions had destroyed everything. Only in remote Ireland did civilization continue, most especially in the monasteries. And the monks in Ireland were not all content with being home and safe and holy. A missionary movement grew up. St. Columba went to Scotland, St. Dunod went to Wales, St. Aidan went to England, and so on. Partly the motive was missioning, bringing the gospel back to places that had lost it. But I have read that it was also seen as a spiritual discipline, a lifelong penance, to wander forever and never call any place home. There are even traditions that some of these monks sailed westward towards unknown lands. St. Brendan has grown from history into legend into myth, but there are hints from the other side of the Atlantic. I heard in Mexico how some of the legends of the gods there could best be explained if a monk had been shipwrecked there, half-drowned, one day, centuries ago. Thursday the 16th is the feast day of St. Gall. He was an Irish missionary who travelled first to Gaul and then to what is now the corner where Austria, Germany and Switzerland meet. He was a powerful preacher, but he refused to take official posts as Bishop of Constance or Abbot of a monastery. He lived as a hermit in the woods near Lake Constance, and legend says that in his hermitage he was accompanied by a bear which would gather firewood with him. I want to explode that legend of the bear. We label too many things as legendary just because they happened long ago. In 1942, the Poles, who had been being starved and worked to death in Russia, were allowed out to Persia to form an army. On their way to Tehran, they met a bear cub whose mother had been killed. They named him Wojtek and fed him on condensed milk until he was old enough to eat. He slept with the soldiers, he wrestled with them and drank beer with them, he ate the cigarettes they gave him. He learned to march and salute and was given the rank of corporal. In the Battle of Monte Cassino he helped his unit carry crates of ammunition. After the war he came to Scotland and spent his retirement in Edinburgh Zoo, enjoying visits from his Polish comrades in arms. So just because St. Gall's bear was the companion of a saint, that is no reason to believe that he didn't exist. Unthinking incredulity is just as bad as unthinking credulity. You might even call it spiritual cowardice. If there is one saint this week who conspicuously failed to have cowardice, spiritual or any other kind, it is St. Teresa of Avila, whose feast is on the 15th. Teresa was born in Avila in 1515. after its mysterious beginnings on Mount Carmel and its early centuries of extreme austerity, the Carmelite order had settled into a rational and socially useful role. In Spain, a Carmelite convent was a place where unmarried ladies could live together in comfort, not too far from town, so that their friends could come and visit and share all the latest gossip. God knew his place, and he did not interfere, though if anyone happened to have holy feelings, he was always available. Really, if such an institution had not existed for unmarried women of a certain class, it would have been necessary to invent it. Teresa entered her Carmelite convent at the age of 20. In her autobiography, she is careful to tell us that she had no particular vocation to be a nun. She was not so much going into the convent as she was going out of the world. She tells us just enough about that world to show that she knew that underneath the froth and gaiety there was poison lurking. Some of us have to be a lot older than 20 before we discover that. Teresa was bad at prayer, like most of us. She seems to have had the same distractions too, but God took charge in the end, and she was led high up the mountains of mystical prayer. That is a frightening place to be, but there were confessors and spiritual directors to help her distinguish mysticism from delusion. As she became a better and better contemplative, Teresa began to realize that Carmelite convents, as they then were about the worst possible place for serious prayer and contemplation. They were protected from the world's dangers, but not from its distractions. She longed for a stricter, more enclosed place. As she learned more about the original, primitive Carmelite rule, she realized that what she was really looking for was a Carmelite convent. Not Carmelite-flavored, as the convents of her day were, but actual religious institutions. Then began a long and complicated war. Not all Teresa's opponents were actually enemies or even wrong-headed. One did have to consider practicalities, even money and resources. Putting 12 women plus a prioress into a damp house where they would quickly die of pneumonia and malnutrition would do no good for either God or man. The convent of St. Joseph was founded in 1562 when Teresa was 47. It was a success. 16 other convents followed. 6 years later, the first community of men was founded, which followed the Theresian reform. Teresa herself became an outstanding contemplative, and her writings on contemplative prayer and the various stages of it are still fundamental texts on the subject. They are the reason why she is a doctor of the church. On Saturday the 18th, we have St. Luke the Evangelist. He was a companion of St. Paul. He was well-educated, a doctor, and wrote good, proper, literate Greek. My late doctor friend Corinne particularly appreciated Luke's treatment of the story of the woman with a hemorrhage who touched the hem of Jesus' garment and was cured. Mark says that after long and painful treatment under various doctors, the woman had spent all she had without being any the better for it. In fact, she was getting worse. Luke simply says, a hemorrhage which no one had been able to cure, and leaves it at that. There is medical solidarity for you. That's all for this week. If you'd like to write to us about anything, send an email to universalis@universalis.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Have a good week in every sense, and let's pray for one another.